Welcome to episode 6 of Hey Min Lee Mysteries Resolved. My name is Debbie Simons, and this week we are going to answer the enduring question in this case, what about Jay? Jay Wiles, that is, the only supposed eyewitness who stood up at Adnan's trial and said he knew all about Adnan's involvement in this supposed crime on Adnan's part. The crime itself, alas, is too real. He is the one who supposedly led the police to Hay's car on February 28th, and he's been the sticking point for many people who want to believe that Adnan Syed is innocent, but who keep coming back to this enigmatic figure. So I hope in this podcast episode that I lay some of these persistent questions to rest. Before I actually plunge into Jay himself, I want to pick up where I left off last week, which was with the discovery of Hay's body, discovery in quotation marks, of Hay's body in Leakin Park by another mysterious figure whom I spent a lot of time discussing last week, Alonzo Sellers, and then the transfer of the case from Baltimore County under the able, I have to say, direction of Joseph O'Shea, one of the police detectives, over to Baltimore City under the perhaps somewhat shadier direction of Detectives Ritz and McGillivary, of which much more later. So we know that once Hay's body is discovered within the jurisdiction of Baltimore City, the case has to be transferred over, and that O'Shea met with Ritz and McGillivary to give them the files. They didn't just send it over by bike courier. He sat down with them and he went over the case. Now, I want us to think a little bit about what O'Shea would actually have said at this meeting. Again, an idea that I have never seen explored anywhere else. So I hope I established for all time in episode 4 that the Baltimore County Police had indeed done their homework in trying to break Don's alibi. They had checked it out repeatedly from different angles, and they had not succeeded in uncovering the fact that it had been falsified. I think I mentioned back then, if I didn't, let me mention it here, and if I'm repeating myself, my apologies. But one of the things that the Baltimore County Police are accused of is, in Rabia Chaudhry's words, failing to uncover the fact that Anita Baird was Don's mother. So I will just ask here, or ask again, if I've already done so, how on earth were they supposed to do that? All right, on to this meeting, which we know took place, and I'm assuming it would have taken a day for everybody to realize, oh my goodness, this is that girl. This case has now got to be moved. Its jurisdiction needs to be transferred. So O'Shea says to the new detectives, probably in so many words, guys, we have nothing. We have two possible suspects, Don Kleindienst, this young woman's current boyfriend, and then we have this guy named Adnan Syed, who was her boyfriend until last December sometime. She broke up with him to start dating this new guy. Adnan Syed and Hayman Lee are students, or in Hay's case, were students at Woodlawn High School. And everybody we've talked to about this Syed guy says he's a good guy, he's a great student and an athlete, and everybody likes him. And to all appearances, he and Hay continued to have a perfectly cordial relationship after they broke up. He wasn't going around all glowering and plotting revenge and spewing out threats. No, he's actually had several girlfriends since then. So we just don't think he's on the map. We did get a tip. We got an anonymous call on February 1st. It named both of these guys, and we tried to check both of them out. We even went to Woodlawn to try to talk to people about Adnan, and everybody says they don't know anything. And so we are sorry to be saying this, but we're kind of handing you a big, fat, juicy zero. We've done the best we can. We hope now that the body has actually been discovered, maybe there will be some clues in the forensic evidence, in the autopsy. So you'll have to take it from there. We're now off the case. I think that's all perfectly imaginable and perfectly legitimate. Now, there is one matter I need to address here, something that has never been solved. And I don't know what happened. But somehow, in the transfer of the case from Baltimore County to Baltimore City, a key piece of evidence just vanished. And that was Hay's computer. And as far as I know, looking back on my own trail of ownership of computers, this was probably not a laptop. There were laptops in 1999. I had a very primitive one, I'd say in the late 90s. But for the most part, when people talked about having a computer, they were talking about a desktop with a monitor and a CPU and disk drives, all that kind of thing. Something, in other words, quite bulky. And yet that computer disappeared. And we know that the Baltimore County Police Department had that computer and that they were trying to get into it, trying to figure out what Hay's passwords were. Bob Ruff is, as always, admirable on this subject. And he says that there was a guy there, I don't remember the name, their tech guy or computer guy, who had been working on getting into the computer and analyzing it. But then, of course, when Hay's body was discovered, he was told, okay, you need to stop working on this because all of this is going to be transferred over to Baltimore City. So where did that computer go? We simply do not know. And it would be very helpful. We know, for instance, that Hay kept a separate diary on that computer. She says in her paper diary at one point, I haven't written in this book for, I don't know what she says, a month maybe. There are big gaps in that paper diary. But she says, I did write on the computer. And it would be so interesting to know what other stuff she wrote there. But we have nothing. We also know, at least we think we know, that she was fairly active in some chat rooms, as they were called back then, discussion groups related to Korea. That might or might not be relevant to this case, but it would still be very interesting. But all of that has disappeared. Is it sitting somewhere in an evidence locker at Baltimore City? I guess we're just not going to know. So the police have, the Baltimore County Police have transferred the case over. And at this point, the case is going to move forward under the direction of this new homicide unit. And this is going to lead to the involvement of Jay Wilds and ultimately the arrest and conviction of Adnan Syed. Jay is a key figure here, even though, and hear me well, he had not one iota of involvement in Hay's death. So now we can back up and try to look at Jay himself as a person. And I really wanted to be able to delve into his childhood and background, family background. I wanted to see if I could figure out how this very attractive, in some ways quite bright young man ended up living with his grandmother in a very sketchy neighborhood with no car because he couldn't afford one, always having to catch rides or borrow cars. And of course, that borrowing of cars is the root cause of this whole schmozzle with Jay and Adnan's involvement in the case. And his only job up until February of 1999 being a small-time weed dealer in constant danger of being arrested. How did that happen? Well, the short answer is, I just don't know. I have been unable to find out anything about Jay's early life. The first time that we really know anything about him for sure is when he is a sophomore at Woodlawn High School and he starts dating Stephanie McPherson and things go on from there. Interestingly enough, the first source that we have, a first-hand source that we have about Jay, is Adnan Syed himself. And I'm going to read you a section of a letter that Adnan wrote to Sarah Koenig, probably back in 2013. I'm not completely sure that there's a specific date, but it has to be around 2013 because Sarah Koenig wanted to hear from Adnan. She wanted to know more about him and about the case, what his view was, why he felt that he was innocent. In her words, and this makes a lot of sense, she was saying, look, I don't want to spend a year of my life investigating what I think is a wrongful conviction case, only to find out at the very end that the guy was guilty after all. Now, that is sort of the conclusion she comes to at the end, but of course, that was way in the future at this point. So she specifically, after looking through the documentation, looking at the materials Rabia had provided, and doing some digging of her own, she really wanted to know, again, what about Jay? How can you explain Jay? So Adnan writes her a quite long and very well written, I must say, letter from prison trying to answer this question. So I'm reading this section from Adnan's letter. It is quoted in Rabia Chaudhry's book, Adnan's Story, which I've said many times you should read or listen to, or perhaps both, which is what I've done. So here's what he says. Looking back, I always knew that Jay was jealous of my relationship with Stephanie. He would ask me things when we were smoking weed, like, man, would you tell me if you were screwing Steph? And she talks to you on the phone more than me. Particularly around that time period, Stephanie had told me she was going to break up with Jay when she went off to college. Jay told me and asked me if I knew about it. I told him that I did, and he wasn't too happy about that. And then Adnan bought Stephanie two copies of the 1997 to 98 yearbook so she'd have the picture of Adnan and herself at prom. And we are told that Jay asked Stephanie how she got a hold of those two copies. And when she told him that Adnan had bought them for her, he, as Stephanie puts it, caught an attitude. Okay, so now who is this Stephanie and what is this apparent love triangle going on? You probably know this is Stephanie McPherson, who was a close friend and then a romantic interest on the part of Adnan when he was in middle school. So Adnan says that during the time that he was going to Johnny Cake Middle School, isn't that a great name? Adnan's family also lived on Johnny Cake Road. That's a Civil War term about like cornmeal hush puppies kind of things. Anyway, he and Stephanie were very close friends in middle school, Adnan says. And then when they were in eighth grade, they decided to be boyfriend and girlfriend. Well, what did that consist of? Apparently, it mostly consisted of Adnan's going over to Stephanie's house a lot and playing basketball. With whom? Well, with her, of course. Stephanie, in addition to being a star student, was a star athlete. And so she and Adnan played a lot of basketball during their eighth grade year. But then the summer comes between eighth and ninth grade. And Adnan says, it's still in this same long letter, he says that he and Stephanie didn't see each other much that summer. What was Stephanie doing? Well, she was off at basketball camp. She was using her summer before starting high school as a way to get better at playing basketball so that she could be on the high school girls' basketball team. So good for you, Stephanie. You have goals in mind. What was Adnan doing? Well, Adnan maybe not so admirable. He says that he and his friends had gotten fake IDs, and they were doing a lot of clubbing. Now, I have to stop here and say, what the whatty what? I just don't get this. Adnan is 14 or 15, and he's actually pretty young looking for his age, if you've seen his high school pictures. Legal drinking age in Maryland at this point was 21, not 18. I know that. I researched that because I was looking into the Brett Kavanaugh story, which is a little bit earlier than this. But Maryland had very strict drinking laws. So here's this bunch of, they're basically rising high school freshmen. They're all at most 15. And any bouncer worth his salt at a nightclub would know these kids have fake IDs, and he would, I would think, turn them away. But on the other hand, if the kids have IDs, that kind of gives the nightclub some cover. And of course, if you turn away too many people, you're really cutting into your income. So they're allowed to come in. Nightclubs have varying charges, of course. But typically, there's some kind of cover charge, especially if there's special live music going on. And there's often a minimum drink order, and the drinks are not cheap. So I just find it very difficult to understand, number one, how did Adnan have the money for this? And number two, how did he escape the eagle eye of his mother, Shamin? I have no answers to either of these questions. I do think it's fair to point out, however, that Adnan's money for clubbing did not come from his massive thefts from the offering boxes at the mosque. That is so totally ridiculous. I do not know why Sarah Koenig wasted a big chunk of episode 9 of Serial on that preposterous story. Adnan does say he and his friends took a few little amounts here and there because they did so much work for the mosque. But then I think he got caught, and so he stopped that. So where this money is coming from, I don't know. But it is fair to say that Adnan is not using his summer in quite the same profitable way that Stephanie is with her summer. So when the summer ends and they're looking forward to high school, they agree that they're just going to be friends. No more of this boyfriend-girlfriend thing. And they start at Woodlawn High School. Both of them are in the magnet program. And Stephanie apparently almost immediately sees Jay, or Jay spots her. Now, Jay is tall and somewhat athletic. He did play some sports. Stephanie is tall and gorgeous, and she plays sports. So I don't know. Maybe that's how they got together. It's not clear at all. Jay is not in the magnet program, and he's actually quite bitter in his Intercept article, which will not be until 2015, about the fact that the magnet kids and the regular kids were pretty segregated. He's also unhappy over the fact that the vocational classes were canceled, were shoved out by the magnet program. And yet, in spite of his negative feelings about the magnet program, he is quite taken with Stephanie. And her family, of course, was not at all happy about this. This loser, as they would have seen him. This guy, what does he even do? He's always having to get rides. Stephanie's always having to lend him her car. And does he have a job? Is he going to college when he gets out of high school? What's going on here? They're very negative. They really like Adnan, by the way. So Jay's bad boy image, I'm sure, added to his glamour. And he is a good-looking guy. There's no question about it. By the way, I will also insert here, just as an interesting little fact, Stephanie McPherson is not going to be the only high-achieving, college-bound young woman who attaches herself to Jay, because the same description could be applied to Jennifer Pusa Terry. Now, Jennifer's not really a glamour girl, but we find out when she is later giving her testimony and talking to the police and talking on the HBO documentary, all that kind of thing, that she is no slouch. You kind of tend to think, oh, she's just a fellow pothead of Jay's. They're just two losers who are bound together by their loserness. And she says at one point, Jay has my heart. I think Jennifer very definitely wanted to be more than just Jay's best friend, which is how she is characterized. But at the time of Hay's murder, Jennifer and Jay are both going to be out of high school. Jay is going nowhere, but Jennifer is in college. She is going to the University of Maryland on the Baltimore campus. She is in a sorority. She has friends on campus. She talks about her friend Mike's birthday party that she attends. And she has a job doing what I don't know. Probably something pretty low level and hourly, just something to make some money while she's in college. But she's not a dead ender. And yet she's running around with Jay, and she tells this story at one point about her and Jay almost getting caught by the police because they've been selling drugs. And then she says in the documentary, you have to realize that back then in 1999, selling weed was considered a very big deal, very, very dangerous consequences if you got caught. To which I say, well then, Jennifer, why were you doing it? Why did you get involved with somebody like Jay Wilds? But there it is. He must have had a certain amount of, shall we say, animal magnetism. Okay, so the high school years go on. Stephanie continues her relationship with Jay, but she and Adnan continue to be friends. And there's a description, for instance, Adnan says that sometimes before class, if he and Stephanie had a class together and there were a few minutes before the bell rang, that Stephanie would sit in his lap and mess up his hair and kiss him. And I think, what? And I'm sure that somebody told Jay about this behavior. So that helps explain why Adnan is saying, Jay was jealous of my relationship with Stephanie. Jay can tell which way the wind is blowing. And by the way, by their senior year, Stephanie has already decided, as Adnan outlines in this letter, it's time to move on. But she'll keep things going until she goes off to college. That will provide a natural breakpoint. But that, Stephanie, was a big mistake. And by the way, we also know that Stephanie is the connection with Jay for Adnan to start buying weed from Jay. Again, I just roll my eyes and I sigh and I don't know what else to say here. But Stephanie's kind of important. She's the hinge between these two young men. And I think this sexual jealousy on the part of Jay may explain at least part of why he was willing to stand up at Adnan's trial and lie his head off, knowing perfectly well that he was helping to send an innocent man to prison for a murder he had not committed. Jealousy goes at least a ways in explaining that. The main motive, of course, is that Jay wants to save his own skin, but we'll get to that. All right, now I want to read you something. I ran into this on Reddit, and I don't know where this is from. There is no caption to the picture, but it's very telling. It's that famous photo of Stephanie and Adnan as king and queen of the junior prom, with Adnan wearing that ridiculous crown. But he and Stephanie make a very striking couple. And of course, this is the occasion for Adnan's and Hay's first date. If you've read her diary, you haven't read her diary? Oh my goodness. What have you been doing with your time? Anyway, this is where Adnan is supposed to dance the first dance with Stephanie because they are king and queen. But instead, he comes over and he dances with Hay. All right, so this is that image of Stephanie and Adnan, but there is a note next to it. As I say, I have no idea where this note came from, but let me read it to you. It's from Stephanie, and it says, "Hey, Adnan, we go way back, don't we?" Well, yes, they do, all the way back to junior high. "It's been cool, hasn't it? Don't change, okay? What could have happened, we will never know. Love always, Steph Eve." And her middle name is indeed, I think, Evelyn. So this is Stephanie saying to Adnan, kind of this wistful, what might have been speculation. Huh, what if we hadn't broken up? What if we had kept going all the way through high school? We will never know. And of course, that is absolutely true. Things go very differently for both of them. So with that background in mind, let's move forward to the actual time of Hay's death and how Jay got pulled into the case. I am, first of all, going to be very clear. I've certainly said this about Adnan, that he had no involvement with this case at all. But that is also true of Jay. So let me lay down a marker here before we move forward. If you are going to say that Jay Wilds had no involvement in this case, and that's true, that is just by virtue of the evidence, that is true, then you cannot also say that Jay Wilds made the anonymous phone calls that landed Adnan in the soup. And yet there are very good people who want to have it both ways. I'm going to read you now a brief paragraph from Bob Ruff's podcast. And I've sung Bob Ruff's praises before. He is a wonderful investigator, but he falls into the trap of failing to put himself in the position of actually living through these events. So let me read what he says here. "I believe Jay had nothing to do with this crime. I believe he knew nothing about this crime, and his testimony and subsequent confession were completely coerced by the police. Period." So at this point, I agree with Bob Ruff completely. I think that is exactly what happened, as we will go on and talk about in the rest of this episode. But now let's look at what Bob Ruff says in the next part of this paragraph. So let's walk through a theoretical timeline of Jay as the tipster. February 1st, he calls in with a hope to cash in on the reward money and says that he thinks Adnan did it. That part of the paragraph cannot be true, and indeed is not true. Jay knows nothing. And on February 1st, there is no reward being offered. That comes much later. There are missing posters up with Hay's picture, and I think those had been put up in Hay's neighborhood, perhaps. I got a picture of that, an image of that off of the undisclosed podcast website. It's in my book and the appendix. There isn't even a phone number, which makes me think, again, that these were flyers or posters that were up around Hay's neighborhood where everybody knew who she was. There is no reward. The other theory that's always been offered about, well, why would Jay Wiles make these phone calls, is that he wanted to direct attention away from himself and onto Adnan. Again, that's totally absurd. There is no attention being paid to Jay Wiles at this point. And by the way, by the story he tells, he implicates himself as an accessory after the fact. So if the real reason for him to make these phone calls was to distract from himself, he failed utterly. In fact, he did exactly the opposite. So I'm going to go into these anonymous calls. Of course, there's one, this one on February 1st, which we've already talked about. And then there is going to be a further anonymous call on February 12th that, instead of going to Metro Crime Stoppers, is going to go directly to the Baltimore City Homicide Division. And this is going to lead to the writing of that famous memo by Detective Daryl Massey, who's the one who took the call. We are going to look at that memo in great detail in my episode about the Lee family's involvement in this case. Because make no mistake here, young Lee, Hay's younger brother, is the one who made both of these calls. Mark it down. We'll come back to this later. But here's the thing to keep in mind here as we're talking about Jay. Because the police have been handed this case with no leads by Baltimore County, and then they get this anonymous phone call saying, wait a minute, take a look at the boyfriend. Take a look at Adnan Syed. Oh, well, we thought he was cleared. No, he made definite statements. Oh, that is why the Baltimore City Police pull Adnan's cell phone records and also what's often called his criminal records. They're not really criminal records. He has some traffic stops or something. They're doing that in response to this February 12th anonymous call. And that's why they look at Adnan's cell phone records, because of this call. I know I'm just beating this idea over the head. Please forgive me. But there have been so many outlandish conspiracy theories floated out here that make absolutely no sense. The fact of the matter is Baltimore City is flailing. And the racism that is going to be attached to the Baltimore City Homicide Unit of Ritz, McGillivray, and Massey it's justified, but it's not justified as a reason for a conspiracy. They use race and class as a means of getting at people and making people look more suspicious. But they don't start out by saying, oh man, let's see if we can get some Muslim on the hook for this murder. No, that's not what happens at all. They pull Adnan's cell phone records because of this tip. They see, we all know the story, the well-worn story. There are calls made to Jennifer Pusateri's house, to her landline, that could not have been made by Adnan because he was in school at the time. He has loaned Jay his car and, by extension, his phone, which he's not allowed to take into school, which, remember, he's only gotten the day before. He's loaned it to Jay, he says, so that Jay will go get Stephanie a birthday present. Remember, Jay and Stephanie are still dating. Susan Simpson also says she thinks that Jay and Adnan were doing a little small-time pot dealing on the side. She's probably right about that, as she usually is. But the fact of the matter is that Jay has Adnan's car and Jay has Adnan's phone, and Adnan should never have let Jay know that that phone was in the car because Jay found it just irresistible. If Adnan had left the phone in the glove compartment but shoved it underneath the owner's manual, say, and not said a word to Jay, or if he had hidden it in the back seat, or if he had just said, Now I have to leave my cell phone in the car. Please leave it alone. I just got it yesterday. I'm not completely sure how the whole billing thing works. I don't want to get mixed up in anything I don't understand, so please just leave the phone alone. And if Jay had had the self-discipline to keep his hands off that phone, then he and Adnan, I think it's safe to say, would never have been pulled into this case. But instead, Jay decides, I think I'll make some phone calls on this. And he calls Jennifer Pusateri several times. And that sets the police on his tail because Jen, well, I don't know how exactly to say this. She rats out Jay. Jay tells her, go ahead and give them my name. I'll take care of things. It's never been completely clear how the police made the leap from Jennifer Pusateri to Jay Wiles, but it doesn't really matter. The fact is, they get on to him. And by the way, that reward that Jay is supposedly interested in is not going to be offered until probably January 19th. No. And that reward, by the way, that Jay supposedly wanted to get, that was not even offered until February 19th. A full week after that February 12th anonymous tip to Daryl Massey. I've seen a list of documents requested, documents that have been ordered to be printed. And there's something that says reward poster, and they're ordered on the 19th, and then they're delivered on the 24th. And then there is a reward poster that's out there with a number to Detective McGillivary. So Jay's not after the reward. There is no reward on February 12th. That reward comes from the Lees and the Lees community, with a little bit thrown in by Metro Crime Stoppers. But we'll get to that later. So the tip has been called in. Jay has been pulled in. And the process of these detectives who have been known in the past to coerce witnesses begins. Jay does not have an official police interview until February 28th. That's a kind of an important day. That's the day that Hayes' car is at least officially discovered in a lot that is overlooked by some row houses that have a unit rented by a member of Alonzo Sellers' family. So the car shows up on the 28th, at least in the records. And then, of course, February 28th, 1999, is the day that Adnan is going to be arrested. So we have 19 days from February 9th till February 28th with a number of rather interesting things happening, a lot going on behind the scenes, cell phone records being checked, all that sort of thing going on. There has always also been a story that Jay was being looked at by the police before February 28th and his first official recorded interview. That's probably perfectly true. Somebody, I think this may have been his supervisor at the porn video rental store, so at least he's doing work now that's legal, said that the police were pestering him. She also says that he missed work a couple of times because he said the police had pulled him in to talk to him. And that rather frail evidence has been used to indicate that the police were interviewing Jay long before his official first interview. That may or may not be true. The investigators from the HBO documentary tracked her down. Her name is Sis. And tried to get her to confirm this story, and she was very vague. She said she couldn't remember. Again, this is one of those things that doesn't really matter. What matters is that by February 28th, the Baltimore City cops are on to what they think is the solution to the case. So they do several things on this last day of February. Number one, very early in the morning, I believe the official interview is over at something like 3:30 a.m., they pull in Jay. Now, I'm not going to go through this interview, or indeed any of Jay's interviews in detail, because that has been done so many times. All of the ways that Jay changed his story have been documented fully. I think it's probably 7 or 8 different versions of the story, where Hay's body was, when he and Adna went to Leakin Park to hide the body, blah, blah, blah. It's all obviously been made up. If you listen to the audio of any of Jay's interviews, and I will post a link to this first interview in the show notes, he obviously doesn't know which end is up. He's groping. And then the police will throw him a lifeline, will drop him a hint, and he'll say, right, sorry. And he'll go on with the story. Susan Simpson has documented that at least in some of these interviews, there's this tapping sound when Jay stumbles and grinds to a halt. And then he'll say, and suddenly he'll have the right answer for the next part of the story. I think all of that is perfectly clear that the Baltimore City cops are just thinking, look, here is this young black man. His only employment up until very recently has been dealing pot. He's had run-ins with the police. He's very vulnerable. We can put the screws on him and get him to confess, to pull in this other dude whom we got the call about. How much of this was acknowledged even in their own minds? I don't know. But by the end of that February 28th interview, Jay says, I know where Hay's car is. And it ends with the police saying, will you take us to her car? And Jay says, yes. And then at about 6 a.m., the police are going to show up at Adnan's house and arrest him. Let's look at this car situation. Probably, if you're listening to this podcast, you've seen pictures of Hay's car. It was, as I say, parked in a grassy lot that was kind of an overflow lot for a row of low rental housing units in a very high crime part of Baltimore. And supposedly, this car had been parked there since Hay's death. But we know it has been perfectly clear for a long time that that cannot possibly be true. Absolutely cannot possibly be true. The car is clean. It is unvandalized, and it has some very expensive items in it, among which is that solid gold heart charm that's worth $120 in 1999 money that was in the glove compartment. I would venture to say that when the famous picture or pictures are taken of her car, that it has been parked there for no more than 24 hours. So what happened? How did that car get there? And how did Jay know it was there? Well, Jay did not know it was there. That's the first thing to say. How did it get there? Well, where has the car been all this time? Because remember, as I've mentioned, that car is a big wrench in any theories that do not involve Don Kleindienst and 708 East McPhail Road with its garage. The car has been in that garage all the time. It has to have been. Or maybe, but I think this is kind of unlikely, by the side of the house with a tarp thrown over it. But I don't think they would risk that. It's been parked in that garage all the time because they know that there will be bulletins out for it. And indeed, the Baltimore County Police check several times. These checks have been misidentified as sightings. They are not sightings. They are simply requests for information. That has been pretty well established. Meanwhile, the car is sitting there with the garage door down. Now, 6 weeks or so have gone by, and Don and his mom and Catherine Michelle think, boy, okay, we have got to get this car off the property. We think we can probably move it now. There probably are not alerts still out on it. So why do they park it where they do? Well, here's where poor old Alonzo Sellers gets pulled back in. Oh, my goodness. I don't really feel sorry for him, but still, you have to kind of sympathize just a little bit. They call him, and they say, look, we have one last request. You don't have to do anything, but we need some information. We need to dump this car somewhere, and we need to be able to put it where it wouldn't be terribly suspicious and where it would be far removed from us. We don't want to just park it on the street. We might be spotted doing that. Is there some out-of-the-way spot where it would make sense that a stolen car would be put? And Sellers says, well, I have a cousin maybe, living at this location in a very high crime area of Baltimore. And they've got this kind of vacant lot thing where people park their cars if there's not enough room in the regular parking lot. You could put it there. So that's what I would contend was done sometime on the night of February 23rd or 24th. And I'll get to why I'm using those dates in just a minute. So they drive in, one person, probably Don, driving Hayes' car, and then probably his mother following him. And he pulls into this lot. The car is parked very awkwardly. It's kind of crooked in the spot. Susan Simpson says that it's parked at such an angle that the car next to it would not be accessible via the driver's door. And I think she's right, if you look at the picture carefully. These pictures are all over the internet. I do have both the front and back views of the car as it was photographed in situ in the appendix of my book. So there's another reason to get a hold of my book. But anyway, it's parked at an angle. It's obviously been pulled in kind of quickly. I think whoever was driving was probably very nervous. And the keys are missing. So is the ignition collar, but I think that's a total non-starter as far as being any indication of hot wiring the car. That's not what happened. Those 1998 Nissan Sentras apparently had a lot of problems with the ignition collars popping off. I actually looked that up. So the keys are pulled out. I think they were pulled out quickly, and that's when the collar fell off. But then it would probably have been found in the car. It may have just been that it had fallen off earlier and Hay had never done anything about it. The door is locked, and the person parking it, whom I assume is Don Kleindienst, walks away, gets in the car of the other person who's followed him, and goes back home. And now the car is there in that lot, at a location miles from Bel Air and in a high-crime neighborhood where stolen cars are routinely dumped. So I said earlier, I think the car was discovered on the night of the 23rd or the 24th. Kind of depends on how you date things, whether it's before or after midnight. But we know, this is from Rabia Chaudhry's book, and she must have gotten this from some kind of FOIA request. We know that the police did routine flyovers of these high crime areas. So this is the classic helicopter with the search beam coming down low and trying to spot suspicious activity. If somebody was in the middle of a drug deal, well, the approach of that helicopter would at least make them flee the scene. And then they would also check for stolen cars. Now, I don't think they had the technology in 1999 to actually read license plates from a helicopter, but they at least had the descriptions. So here's what I think happened, and this makes sense in conjunction with this flyover. Hayes' car is spotted that night. We'll say the night of the 24th, sometime after midnight. And the description is called in. This is a new, clean-looking car, even if they don't realize it's Hayes' car. They would have called in the description and sent somebody to look at it and probably to radio in the license plate number and the VIN. Oh, that's that girl's car. This is Heyman Lee's car. How did it get here? We've done flyovers before this. I don't have dates for this, but I'm sure this is true. It wasn't here then. Besides, we know it couldn't have been there all that time. For the previous ideas I mentioned, that it's not vandalized, it's not broken into, there are valuables still in that car. By the way, one thing that I think is very important that would have been so easy to be done if it had been sitting there for any length of time is that the aerial is still in place. And of course, the aerial is a hollow metal tube. And routinely in these high drug use neighborhoods, if you left a car sitting out, your aerial would be snapped off because that little tube worked well as an improvised crack pipe. But it still has its aerial. And the grass, this has been made much of, the grass underneath the car and the grass in the wheel wells and in the tire treads is still green. And it's still in those treads. It has not been washed away by the several storms that have taken place over these weeks since the car disappeared. If you look at the picture, the car next to Hayes has completely bare tires. So the photograph of the car in place was taken the night of the flyover, February 23rd or 24th. And then, and here I was kind of dense for a while, I thought, well, now wait a minute, Jay is not going to testify to where that car is and supposedly take the police there until the 28th. So are the police going to guard that car for 4 days, make sure it stays in place and nobody breaks into it? And then I realized, boy, I'm not very bright here. They took the car to the impoundment lot when they spotted it. And then Jay was almost certainly just shown photographs. And or he may have also been taken to see the car in the impoundment lot. It's been locked and they would have easily been able to get into the car itself. But there were also items in the trunk that were only discovered later. And that trunk would have presented a little more of a problem because it could not be accessed from inside the car. You had to open it with a key. So they would have had to get a locksmith to open up the trunk. We know, for instance, that Jay first said, oh, because Hayes' purse was missing, I saw Adnan throw her purse along with her jacket into the woods when we were hiding her body. But then later, when they get the trunk open, well, lo and behold, there is Hayes' purse and Hayes' jacket. So Jay's story was wrong. He couldn't see those items from the car itself because the trunk hadn't been opened yet. So, armed with this information, with Jay on record with his ridiculous story about helping Adnan hide the body, all this baloney that he spouts, the police show up at Adnan's house later that morning and they arrest him. And the legal process grinds on from there. What happens with Jay in the meantime? Well, the police need to get him to tell a coherent story that they can then present to the prosecution for trial. So that's why they keep bringing him in and keep re-interviewing him. They're getting his story into shape. And a couple of things happen in the fall of 1999, before Adnan's first trial begins. He's going to have a trial in December of 99, but as we all know, that's going to end in a mistrial. Two things happen with Jay. Number one, he is given a plea deal, a plea agreement. He's assigned a really very good lawyer. Her name is Ann Benaroya. I think she got royally played by Kevin Urich, the lead prosecutor. She obviously feels sorry for Jay, and she gets him a very favorable plea agreement. But if you read that agreement, it is very clear that the deal that has been made where Jay will not be prosecuted for murder or for accessory after the fact is totally contingent on his testifying to Adnan's involvement. So that's point number one. It's a carrot and a stick all in one. Jay has been told, work with us and we'll make sure you don't do any time. And oh, by the way, you're kind of an unsympathetic character. An all-white jury might just decide you should get the death penalty. So you better cooperate with us. That's point number one. And then point number two, which I am convinced is what happened, is that on November 1st, 1999, Jay Wilds gets the reward that was posted with Metro Crime Stoppers, a reward of $3,075. Now, if we go back in time to that leaker about Metro Crime Stoppers, the one who emailed and said, yes, I know all about this tip. She said the reward was paid out to the tipster on November 1st. So Jay almost certainly got that money. We know that's pretty much because Jay then did go ahead and buy that longed-for motorcycle that he had been wanting for so long, but he didn't have the money. So now, wait a minute here, you say. Debbie, hold the phone. If Jay Wilds got the reward, how can you say that he didn't make the call? Well, because he didn't. He didn't know beans from bologna, another saying from my father. My parents seem to keep popping up in this podcast. He doesn't get the reward until November 1st, but he should have gotten it if he was really the caller on April 1st, because the way these reward lines worked was that the tip would come in, and then the following month, there would be a meeting with the Metro Crime Stoppers staff and representatives from the police who had a say in these cases that had been called in. And then if it was determined that the tip had been genuine and it had been helpful, then the money would be paid out. But remember, as I said earlier, the only ID that was given to a tipster was a 4-digit number. You had to remember that number. If you forgot it, if you lost it, you don't get a reward because that is your only connection. And then you have to call in and say, I am tipster number so-and-so. I want my reward. So what happened? Well, guess who else would have that number? Not the name, folks, because the name has never been recorded. But the number, it would be the police. Some representative from Baltimore City Homicide, Ritzer McGillivary or Massey or one of their subordinates, had gone to a meeting and been told, we got this tip. But nobody ever calls in a request for the reward. So now we've moved forward to, we'll say, late October. And Adnan's trial has been scheduled for December. And he's in jail awaiting trial. And I postulate that Jay was showing signs of getting cold feet here. After all, he is being asked to get up on the stand and implicate somebody for murder, not just for stealing a car or even for drug dealing, but for murder. And I think he was starting to show a little bit of hesitation, and the decision was made. Okay, well, I think the time has come to give him a bit of a spoonful of sugar. Let's promise him that reward. In fact, let's get it to him. We'll show him that we're really on his side. And so Jay is given that ID number. He calls. He meets up with the MCS representative. He's given the money in cash. He goes off. He buys his motorcycle. And in December, and then again in February at Adnan's second trial, he will stand up there and he will say, Adnan Syed killed Haman Lee. He does it partly to save his own skin. He does it partly, perhaps, in appreciation for the money. And I think he does it partly because of his long simmering sexual jealousy about Adnan and Stephanie. And so there the story rests for the time being. Next week, we're going to talk about those anonymous calls, what makes me think that the Lees made them, and what else the Lee family did. Come back then and hear what I have to say.